This is Crossroads, the Get Religion podcast.
When you hear about journalism being slanted, you usually think of a political slant to the journalism. It's unbalanced. That's why it slants. It tips over because it's not a balanced journalism. It covers one side but not the other. Well, there's also a slant when it comes to religion reporting as well. Terry Mattingly has found what he considers a very egregious example of that in a paper that had up until recently been a stellar example of good religion reporting. It's a little puzzling. Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So for you to say that a story is one of the most slanted things you have read in the mainstream of media in a long time is really saying something. Why do you say that?
Well, this is a story where to simply know what's going on, there are voices that really have to be quoted on both sides. And the story comes across as a kind of, frankly, a kind of public relations release from the people who want to see Azusa Pacific University outside of L.A. change its approach to human sexuality and moral theology. And I want to stress that, especially since the story concerns a controversy at the school involving the LGBT community, that obviously liberal evangelicals who want to see doctrines changed there are an essential part of this story. I also understand that this isn't the first time the Los Angeles Times has written about conservative evangelical Protestants. And it is possible, although the story does not say this, it is possible that they tried to talk to traditional evangelicals on this campus and were denied interviews. If that's the case, then the story needed to say that. But the story has all kinds of valid material from students on the campus who oppose the school's teaching that sex outside of marriage is sin, and then oppose the school's defense of traditional definitions of marriage. Now, the thing that makes the Azusa story fascinating is how far do you go in affirming visible public displays of affection involving same-sex relationships that come short of sexual relationships. What the school seemed to be saying is it's really hard to know whether students, gay or straight, are having sex. We can't police their bedrooms effectively. We can't do anything like that. So maybe we should allow dating among gay students. I have thought for a long, long time and discussed it, and I have discussed it with gay activists, that the loophole in a lot of Christian educational institutions' policies on sexuality is that they haven't stopped and thought about dating. If the policy says you can't have sex outside of marriage, then are you saying that gay people can't date? That a gay couple can't walk across your campus holding hands? That you can't have, you know, people sitting on a park bench on the quad and a straight couple is sitting over there, let's just say, having a good time in terms of public displays of affection? Well, why can't a gay couple do that? You don't have a policy against that. You've said they can't have sex, and you've said straight people can't have sex either outside of marriage. But what's wrong with gay dating? That's really the issue that's come up at Azusa. But once you get into the story, the key issue is that opponents of the school's policy, the school briefly said, we are going to allow same-sex relationships that stop short of sexual intercourse. We're going to allow those relationships to exist, and our school will openly support a kind of gay-friendly ministry that will affirm and help gay students feel at home on the campus. The key there is that the people who run the ministry would basically be affirming of gay identity as a public statement in a Christian community. Well, the administration did this, and then all heck broke loose. Our own Julia Dean did a piece about the press reactions and the reactions in some conservative circles, and the mainstream press from the beginning obviously was opposed to Azusa Pacific. After this public announcement, the board of trustees at the school came back and said, hey, nobody cleared this change with us, and the trustees are the final authority on the campus, which happens to be true. So when I say this story is incredibly slanted, what I mean is that there are no voices in the story that make a case for the school's policy. There is no discussion of their religious views. There's no discussion of what they're saying about sexual orientation, positive or negative. They basically don't exist. You have like 100 students at a public protest at a school of 5,600 students, and that 100 students essentially are the voices you get to hear, with the exception of one faculty member who is quoted anonymously, because if he or she was quoted publicly by name, they would get fired, which brings up another point that's crucial in this story. What are the doctrines that students and faculty have affirmed in order to study and teach at Azusa Pacific? These are normally called lifestyle covenants or doctrinal covenants. At one point in my piece today, I said joining this protest on campus means either A, I lied when I joined this association in terms of signing the documents to become a student or a faculty member, B, I have changed my mind on these doctrines, or C, I believe the school is wrong and needs to change its doctrines, or some combination of these positions. It was perfectly appropriate to quote people on the liberal evangelical side of that debate. My point is, how do you write this story and have it be considered complete in terms of discussing this controversy with no on-the-record sources on the other side of the debate? Where are they?
Well, answer your question. It's not like the Los Angeles Times is an amateur operation running out there. So laying aside the possibility of amateur journalism, how does it happen?
Well, the Los Angeles Times used to be one of the standard bearers for excellence in the field of religion coverage. Back when I was active in the field, and in the 80s and 90s, there was really no newspaper in America that had better religion writing, led by one of my heroes in the craft, Russell Chandler. So seeing this kind of coverage in the LA Times is particularly disappointing. I think it is possible to say that a general assignment reporter was assigned to this, and they didn't, frankly, know a lot. The problem is that they called a lot of excellent sources on the liberal side of this article, of this position. So there are signs that the person who wrote this either had help from people on the liberal evangelical side of things, or that this was frankly a quality reporter who chose to dig up good information and good sources on the left, and then, for whatever reasons, did not do it on the right, which is why I called the story slanted. It's half of a good story. Now, is it possible, as I mentioned before, that there were voices at Azusa Pacific who declined to talk to this reporter, either trustees or... It would be really something if faculty members at Azusa who wanted to affirm the school's teachings on morality, marriage, and sex Wouldn't it be amazing if they were scared to talk publicly?
That would be a story in itself.
Yeah, that in effect, it's become controversial on the campus to affirm 2,000 years of Christian teaching on these topics. But whatever, those voices are essential to even being able to verify that certain facts in the story are right. There are claims made about the school's finances and other things that really you shouldn't accept one side of the argument's take on the facts with no attempt to verify it with folks on the other side.
Terry, I don't know what it's like for a reporter who is on a deadline, and maybe they are just a general assignment reporter, so they're not familiar with the religious sensibilities that are in play in the story, but is it possible that the reporter, having been on a campus or two, a typical kind of secular campus, simply assumed that it was going to be near impossible to find a student who doesn't support the LGBTQ agenda in some form or another?
Well, there's one paragraph in the story that mentions what the policies are at Biola. It then contrasts it with the fact that there's a Jesuit school in the area that has no policies on any of these things at all. And it's possible that the reporter simply said, well, a Christian school is a Christian school, and they don't all agree, etc. Except it then gets into a discussion of a previous controversy in the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities involving Eastern Mennonite and Goshen. So the reporter here, whether they knew it or not or had help, there is a lot of information in this story that is quite nuanced, which, if anything, to me, makes the problems with the story even worse, because there's information that indicates that there were people involved in this story that either knew quite a bit about the debates within Christian colleges, or they had sources that told them a lot about these debates from only one side, which, if anything, that's why I considered this story to be such a blatant example of partisanship on this issue, or advocacy journalism on this issue, is not because the story was just bad. It was actually good at representing certain perspectives and points of view. It just wasn't interested at all in voices on the other side. I ended my piece with a quote that I've always used when discussing media bias on these kinds of issues, and it's from a man writing in 2003 about a story linked to abortion. And this story in the Los Angeles Times had made zero attempt to understand the views of opponents of abortion who believed that there was scientific evidence of a link between abortion and an increased risk of breast cancer. The end of this memo about it really says everything that I would want our listeners to know about. Let me just read this quickly. Apparently, the scientific argument for the anti-abortion side is so absurd that we don't need to waste our readers' time with it. The reason I'm sending this note to all section editors is I want everyone to understand how serious I am about purging all political bias from our coverage. We may happen to live in a political atmosphere that is suffused with liberal values and it's unreflective of the nation as a whole, but we are not going to push a liberal agenda in the news pages of the Los Angeles Times. Now, here comes the key statement. I'm no expert on abortion, but I know enough to believe that it represents a profound philosophical, religious, and scientific question. And I respect people on both sides of this debate. A newspaper that is intelligent and fair-minded will do the same. That was written by the editor of the Los Angeles Times, at that time John Carroll, in 2003. That exact memo could have been written about the story we're discussing today. The issue was, did they want to make any attempt at all to let readers know what people on the other side of the debate believed, how they feel about this issue, where they think it's going, etc.? No respect was shown for people on the other side of the issue.
I guess this raises a more general question, and you raised the term advocacy journalism. I want you to explain that as opposed to journalism, if you would. But also, does it achieve its goal? I suppose that the goal of advocacy journalism is to so represent stories as to sway public opinion,
right,
something like that. What's the difference between the two, advocacy journalism and journalism, and does it actually, when done, and it's done all over the place, especially in Europe, does it achieve its goal?
Well, in Europe, you have a tradition of newspapers openly stating their political affiliations and stating what their biases are. We have that in America in magazines and in types of talk television and talk radio, et cetera, where people wear their biases on their sleeves. The problem right now is that a paper like the Los Angeles Times hasn't told its readers, by the way, we have the following editorial position on homosexuality, and you're not going to see us deal with the other side. Now, when you say, what's the effect of this? My first inclination to say is one of the primary effects is a lowering in trust for the among the public in the institutions of journalism. In other words, we trust the people, the publications that tell us what we want to hear, and we don't trust the ones that don't. And we're seeing this continually now, that some publications, you know, like CNTV, Fox News versus MSNBC, I mean, obviously the viewers are not interested in hearing information from the other side, other than maybe one or two normal formatted news shows, like the 6 p.m. news on Fox. Anyway, my point is, one of the side effects of this, more than convincing people that you're right or wrong, is I think we're driving people away from journalism. That to some degree, the Los Angeles Times has decided that it doesn't want customers out of half of the population of L.A. or the United States. So advocacy journalism essentially can be defined as journalism that has already decided who's right on some of these very contentious issues, and you're going to go into the story since you already know who's right. There's no need to show respect or even accurate coverage of the views of people on the side of the issue that you have already predetermined is right. Now, obviously, there are conservative religious publications that do exactly the same thing. There are liberal religious publications that do the same thing. We're talking about the dominant newspaper of one of America's most important cities and a paper that's read across the country. When they do this sort of thing at the New York Times, the LA Times, the Associated Press, it literally, at that point, I would argue, affects all debate in America and all public discourse. And ultimately, I think it hurts the trust that at least half the nation places in journalism.
I think Fox News, in the ancient days, had one of the best journalism mottos I had ever heard. I don't know if they've lived up to it, which is, we report, you decide, which kind of is, to me, the definition of journalism. The New York Times has recently come up with one that it's been showcasing on Twitter, and with 1 minute, I'd like your thoughts on it. Their new slogan is, our facts are your proof. What do you make of that with only 1 minute, Terry?
I'm not familiar with that slogan. I remember about a decade ago, I was interviewing the editor at that time, Bill Keller, and he said that he thought of their slogan as all the facts, all the news that's fit to print. You know, that's the old slogan. He said, what we really have is all the news that's fit to print and what it means. Now, that last clause is crucial because, in effect, the editors are saying, we get to tell you what, not only, we're not just going to cover the debate at the end, we're going to tell you what it all means, which comes awfully close to being, we're also going to tell you who's right. That's, frankly, European journalism. And the Times does fantastic coverage in areas like business and in a lot of international subjects. And I'm now talking about the New York Times. But I would say that it has consistently struggled in certain types of religion stories, and we've written about that a lot. The Los Angeles Times, as I mentioned earlier, it's particularly disappointing – to see the paper now have almost nothing of quality related to religion coverage and to miscover some of these things, because those of us who care about religion news used to respect the Los Angeles Times as one of the top papers in the world in this field, and that's just not something we can say now.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, talk with you again next week.
You bet. Glad to talk to you.
I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.